If you guys are hearing things that you think shouldn't be there, please give us a report. And I wonder if you're running, are you running all the power you because both you and I are getting covered. I wonder if you've got a little more steam you could use and repeat that question. You did get covered that time, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the tech man.
KC2WGB, any better now, Dick?
Fantastic. Please keep doing that. Go ahead and repeat the question, John.
Okay, Dick, very good. All right, Young Amateur is working with piston attenuators, similar to the one that's in the HP, which you're very familiar with. His question is, he'd like to know how they work, actually, what do they do? And his second question is, the piston and the cylinder, are they electrically shorted together as it slides in and out, or are they isolated with maybe some type of insulating sleeve? Maybe you can give him a rundown on the basic construction and how it performs its duty. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Very fine. The piston and the outer conductor are definitely electronically connected to each other. They're usually finger stocked between the two, just to make sure there isn't any sneak path of the radio signal to go around the side of the piston. The piston attenuator works because the round pipe that is the attenuator assembly is so small in diameter that it is waveguide beyond cutoff. In other words, what the magic of wave is that you can send a signal down a waveguide with no center conductor if and only if one of the dimensions of the waveguide is a half wavelength or greater. So if one dimension is half wavelength or greater, then the signal will flow down. And the nice thing about waveguide is it tends to have very low loss. Okay? If you intend to set up the waveguide for the piston attenuator to be much too small, way below half wavelength in any one dimension, you might set up that piece of pipe so that it's a tenth of a wave or a twentieth of a wave in diameter. Under normal circumstances, that signal will flow down there and experience tremendous loss. When I say tremendous loss, I mean 20 dB of loss in the first 2 inches, so to speak. Tremendous dB of loss when this wave got beyond cutoff. However, that loss follows a very exact rule. The loss you get in a piece of waveguide beyond cutoff is an extremely exact number of dB per inch. So therefore, you launch your signal into the waveguide with a small launching loop, which, by the way, has got a 50 ohm resistor at the end of it, because that loop is looking into a nearly short circuit radio-wise. You have another pickup loop downrange that's on the piston that you move back and forth. As you adjust the number of inches between those two, you determine a very exact number of dB of attenuation. The nice thing about that piston attenuator is it can be extremely well calibrated, and if you had to dial in 113 dB on that, you can very easily do it, and the total length of the assembly that will give you 113 dB of loss is probably 7 inches long, if you know what I mean. So you try to set up an attenuator by switches and resistors, and you try to get a fraction of a dB at a time and 110 dB of it, it would be a very difficult assembly. To do it with a piston attenuator, it's an extremely easy and exacting method of doing it. That's good news. There's one piece of bad news about a piston attenuator assembly, and that is if you want to adjust it, you want to grind it down all the way to 0 dB of insertion loss. That's the area where its accuracy degrades real fast, and it doesn't behave in a good manner. So piston attenuator, if you want to get 10 decibels minimum to 110 decibels maximum, very easy. If you want to dial 0.15 dB out of it, you can't get there. It's got a crazy non-calibrated zone near the bottom end, if you know what I mean. So used properly, beautiful piece of equipment. If you ever take apart a Hewlett-Packard 608 signal generator, if you ever get one of those on the surplus market, sometimes they're very inexpensive, and you take apart that attenuator on the front end, you'll be looking at that assembly you're describing. Not very elaborate, not very expensive to produce, but very precision piece of equipment. that does a fantastic job. KC2 WGB, like hearing your high power. K2 RIW, the tech man.
Yes, unfortunately we need it, but that's life. One other question, Dick. Is the length and the distance it translates throughout, is it repetitively accurate? If you were to put a mark or a scratch on it, and you would pull it out and return it to that scratch, being that it was temperature compensated, would it return to the same rating?
Absolutely. That great big dial you've got on the front end of a Hewlett-Packard 608 signal generator, where the outer notches are a fraction of a dB each, is that repetitive? Oh boy. You might have a little bit of a backlash. In other words, your particular dial cord mechanism that goes between that knob and the piston attenuator, maybe you always have to dial it in the clockwise manner in order to settle onto the number you want. And if you then turn it counterclockwise, you might get a little bit of a backlash. And if you're smart enough to reset it the next time by again going a little bit too far to the left, then going back clockwise and stopping at the number you want, and if you always stop clockwise, you get fantastic repeatability. I think you can get repeatability close to 1 or 2 tenths of a dB out of a piston attenuator. It's just a matter of whether or not you move the piston back into the right spot, and that's a function of whether or not there's any backlash in your dial cord assembly that's actually doing the moving. A piston attenuator also has almost no temperature characteristic. As long as you've made that outer conductor out of something that doesn't have a lot of expansion versus temperature, if you're smart enough to make it out of invar metal, then the piston attenuator could, in theory, have essentially zero temperature characteristic. Ain't that nice? Now you know why Hewlett-Packard and many other companies manufactured piston attenuators and did it for decades. And in fact, you can still buy them today. And they're traceable to the Bureau, John. KC2 WGB, K2RIW, the tech man.
WGB. Very good. Also, Dave, what you recommended there with over travel and return, that's true with any measurement device, by the way, whether it's a micrometer or a depth gauge. That's very true. People should realize that. That is how you, and you always have to do it in the same manner. You always have the same accuracy. Yeah, good information.
Okay, we're ready for the next one. We're ready for the next one, John. Go ahead. if they were really following the exact definition of a signal strength meter, 50 microvolts should be S9. And how many dBm is 50 microvolts? There's multiple ways you can get there. Know that 1.0 microvolt is minus 107 dBm. 107 dB weaker than a milliwatt is 1 microvolt on a 50 ohm line. So, and when you go from 1 microvolt to 50 microvolts, let me think now. 1 microvolt to 100 microvolts is a 100 to 1 in voltage. That's 10,000 to 1 in power. That's 40 dB. 1 microvolt to 100 microvolts is, I just gave the number. I forgot it already. 40 dB. 50 microvolts, which is the definition of S9, half that voltage, 6 dB lower than 46, plus 34 dBm. So 50 microvolts plus 34 dBm, if I did the mathematics correctly, is S9 by definition of the usual calibration of a signal strength meter. Let me reset. Okay, I think we've reset everything. The 50 microvolts is S9. And the way the S meter is set up, each S unit, S8 is 6 dB weaker, S7 is 6 dB weaker. In other words, S8 is half the number of volts. 50 microvolts is S9, 25 microvolts is S8. And by the way, since he's heading east, I know this is only going to work temporarily, and I'll flip around the other way. We'll keep him running back and forth on the expressway all night long. So you could find out how well calibrated your particular S meter is. And the way I did it, and the way anybody can do it, if you get your hands onto a good signal generator that has calibrated output, you can put that signal generator with the right kind of adapters and cables and whatever into the front end of your receiver, set the signal generator at various numbers, and record what your S meter reads. Very, very few S meters on the available receivers have anywhere near proper calibration. If this is the best of all worlds, S9 would be 50 microvolts, S8 would be 25 microvolts, and so on. Nobody's S meter does that. They tend to be very expanded at the low end, very compressed at the high end. So you can run a calibration chart where your particular S meter reading, you can find out what is the real signal coming out of the signal generator, and now you know where the truth is. That's one approach. The way I did it is I went one step beyond that. I actually measured the automatic gain control voltage that was coming out of my receiver. Let me reset. I measured the actual S meter reading, signal strength, and I measured the automatic gain control voltage of my receiver. I put an extra connector, and I was using it into a vacuum tube voltmeter, which has got a 10 mega ohm input. You've got to worry about the fact that almost all receivers, automatic gain control voltage is a 1 mega ohm circuit. It's a very sensitive circuit. You don't want to load it down. So as long as you're using a 10 mega ohm meter, like a modern day digital voltmeter, or an old fashioned vacuum tube voltmeter, no problem. If you're using a modern, a volt ohm milliammeter, only 20,000 ohms per volt, you will not get the right reading. Your voltmeter will load down that circuit. So know that of almost all receivers, automatic gain control is a very high impedance, easily overloaded circuit, if you know what I mean. So once you're using the right kind of a voltmeter, you can now take precise digital voltage readings of your S meter, so to speak, your automatic gain control function of your receiver versus various settings of your signal generator. So you can do exact calibration. I did that on 432 way back in 1970. And the net result was everybody on the 432 band would call me up and say, please get on the air, tell me how strong my signal is. And I'd say, you're running 57 microvolts tonight, or I could give it to him in dBm if he wanted to. And so the guy, every time he made a change in his antenna where he could mount it higher, or he went to a higher gain Yagi, or he added some extra elements, he would say, hey, Dick, how many microvolts are you getting tonight? And more than 200 hands on the 432 band would sign into me and ask that question. My goodness, was I popular. I was a very popular guy on 432 because I could give people exact signal strength readings as to how strong the signal was at my house in Smithtown at that time, which was not on top of the hill, if you know what I mean. So If you like metrology, if you like measurements, if you like precision, this is one of the areas where you can have a lot of fun and it doesn't cost a lot of money. You just borrow somebody's signal generator for a while, you connect it with your automatic gain control circuit into a digital voltmeter. Let me drop. You connect it into a digital voltmeter, and you've got that calibration run. And once you've got that calibration run, you have to do it on each one of the bands, by the way. Because I was using my receiver as a tunable IF with a converter, I always operated the receiver on one band, no problem. Disappointingly, you'll find out if you do that calibration shot on 20 meters, your particular receiver might give you a slightly different calibration shot on 40 meters and 80 meters. You have to do a little bit of checking along those lines. But calibrating your receiver versus its signal strength is a fun thing to do. It doesn't cost a lot. You borrow the signal generator, you do it, you give it back. As long as nothing major changes on the receiver, the calibration shot should be good for the next 5 years, if you know what I mean. It's another very nice area. And once you've got that calibrated receiver, and now you set up an antenna range in your backyard, or you can do some very precise measurements to find out what is the real gain of antenna A versus antenna B. You start running comparisons because you've now got a calibrated piece of test equipment, even though Kenwood, Yaesu, and ICOM didn't know it could be used in that manner, if you know what I mean. KC2, WGB, K2RIW. Go ahead, John. John, I wonder if you could transmit into the other frequency, because unfortunately that one didn't come through. KC2 WGB, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, I'll test right now.
Stand by, maybe you don't have to. For the time being, you're coming through, so give it another try. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, I just said that completes the mailbag, and let's take it over to Paul, see what he's got in the space report. KC2 WGB, back to you, Dick.
Very fine, John. Full copy. Okay, I can tell that the guy is possibly going out to the east. Let me double check on that. No, maybe not. Paul, give us a sample transmission, and I think you better use the Eastern repeater at first. WS2N, our space expert, K2RIW in the TechNet.
WS Glenn, very good, Dick. And I'm sure we're doing fine, as you are. A couple of topics here. A little early tonight, but we'll do it.
Beautiful, Paul. You're sounding great.
Fine business. Last week, actually before the net, somebody asked me about the CubeSats that went up here on top of the... Antares to be launched to the International Space Station, which is docked successfully, still there, and they'll eventually fill it up with garbage and things that they don't need on the International Space Station, and they'll burn it up over the Pacific Ocean. But on that payload, you got a lot of stuff. But four items that went up were CubeSats, and there were amateur radio, part of them are amateur radio. I guess eventually they'll get Oscar designations. But I want to know where it was. If I had any information about it. Well, the four that went up, one was built by a bunch of amateurs, not in our country, but Lithuania. And they call it the Lithuanic Sat 1, and if you see it, it's about, well, they give it in centimeters, 10 by 10 by 10, so it's probably 4 by 4 by 4 inches, and only weighs a couple pounds. It's got solar panels that were given to them from a company in Lithuania, and it's going to transmit with an antenna. The antenna is the only functional thing that's actually mechanical thing that moves when they release this thing from the International Space Station. They'll send it out one of the ports there, and along with the other three in about a month from now. So this one operates on 145 and 435 megahertz. I don't have the exact frequencies. I think that's going to be determined later. And so that's one of them. And then they also have another one from that country. That's also going to be sent out on the International Space Station about a month from now, called LitSat. And that's got a VGA camera on board, GPS receiver, a couple of other things there. But again, amateur-wise, it's going to be a transponder for single sideband CW communications. You can have an uplink on 435.180 megahertz and a downlink on 145 on 2 meters, 145.950 megahertz. Also has AX.25 packet, you know, for a packet radio, and they have an uplink, and they gave it as 435.550 megahertz and downlink 145.850 megahertz. I had two more on board. One was from the United States, the Arjusat. I don't have much information on that. What their main purpose of it is to put it up, you know, who built it or anything. But it's got a downlink of 9.6K. I'm not sure what that's all about, but we'll have to look into it. You know, also 437 is involved. Don't have much information on that one. There isn't. The fourth one is put up by a group in Peru. It's a Peruvian satellite. It's UAP SAT-1. So it's actually put out by the Peruvian Wings University. It's found here. So a lot of different groups putting out different satellites. This one's going to be involved with weather and things like that, pretty much. And it'll be retransmitted back down to the people that are interested in this type of thing. So that's the information on the four CubeSats. And they'll be released, like I said, about a month from now by the Japanese astronaut that's presently on board the International Space Station. And a couple of other topics I wanted to mention. If you want to discuss them, you can, but we brought them up quite a bit. One in particular, the TDRS tracking data relay satellite, mentioned last week. And it did successfully launch on an Atlas V rocket. It's our big rocket in this country from Cape Canaveral. And that rocket put it into a geosynchronous transfer orbit, which was around 19,000 by, a couple of thousand miles on the elliptical side. But TDRS has its own rocket, and over time it put itself into a circular orbit. It's there now. It's already called home. I think they got a couple more firings to perfect that location. So that's a good shape. It's one of eight now operating in the TDRS system. Drop it. And I tried to do some math. Dick, you're probably better at it than me. But I did it with diagrams of roughly the size of the Earth, the size of the satellites that normally go around the Earth, like the Hubble Space Telescope, all these other satellites, the SWIFT satellite, a lot of science satellites that need to communicate with Earth, besides the International Space Station, that one as well. If you draw a picture of the Earth and you draw a picture of the orbits of these satellites that are 200, 300, 400 miles up, 400 miles, for instance, like Hubble, it kind of looks close to the Earth, very close to the Earth. Where if you draw a picture of a TDRS satellite at 23,000 miles out on a piece of paper, it's far away from the Earth. And you look to see how the communications are really needed by the low-orbiting satellites by the TDRS satellites, what's involved. You know, the angles that are involved, if you move a satellite roughly across the Earth, for instance, the ISS, and it comes directly overhead. What do you got, 8-9 minutes? That's about it for your receiving station. If you were a receiving station, that means you would need another one probably 9-10 minutes down the road to pick up the slack, and then just continue all the way around every 10 minutes for a 90-minute orbit. What the TGIS does is that's sitting out there, so instead of transmitting down to Earth as it's going around, it looks up at the TGIS, sends the signal up there, picture of a spacewalk or whatever it is, and TGIS sends it back down. And you look at the angle of that, that thing covers, you know, almost one-third of the Earth. It's unbelievable. And then even when communication platform on Earth is transmitted to another TGIS, and that'll send it back down. So between all these different science satellites, NASA and especially the military satellites, use TGIS quite a bit. It's quite a system, but the angles that are involved, it's amazing. Mathematically, you know, it might mean something, but if you ever draw it out, you could really see how this system really benefits anything in orbit. We drop it. And then, if you want to talk about that, we can, or space history, because we're getting toward the end of January. A lot of bad things happened at the end of January. January 27, 1967, you have the Apollo 1 fire. And, you know, this time frame was not good for the NASA system. I mean, they never had any other problems within this 4 or 5 day window. January 27th, then you had Challenger on the 28th. Of course, that was many years later, 1986. And due to the very cold temperatures, that thing never made it to orbit. And then 2 days after that, February 1st, that was just over 10 years ago, 11 years ago now, the Columbia shuttle burnt up coming back from orbit after a 15-day mission. So I want to take up the next time, but all the people that we lost, there were 7 people, I can name them all, on both the Challenger and the Columbus the space shuttle we dropped, as well as the fire on board Apollo 1 back in 67. We lost three people there. Roger Chaffee never flew in space. Ed White, first American spacewalker, and along with Gus Grissom, who were 2 previous missions. Thought I might mention that. And then one other thing that's been actually on the NASA site, they're talking about all our astronomy satellites are now looking at a supernova in this galaxy, M82. That went off, I don't know, some 10 million years ago or something. And their first good look at a supernova, it's a 1A supernova, since quite a few decades, and it's relatively close by. So they like to study these things. These are they call them candle measurement objects. So if one goes off here or one goes off, you know, halfway across the universe, they know how far away it is. Interesting thing to study. The Swift telescope, got to look at it real quick. Naturally, it points Hubble toward it. Chandra X-ray satellite is looking at it. And the new one that we sent up, NASA sent up not too long ago, that we talked about on the new star that was launched by the Pegasus rocket on Vandenberg Air Force Base. That thing studies X-rays. That's looking at the Fermi gamma ray space telescope. We're all looking at it, and they'll probably study this thing until the cows come home. Any questions, Dick, or anything that you want to discuss, or anybody else, we'll be here. And my email is spacenetreport@gmail.com. Back to you, Dick. WS2N.
I thank you, Paul. Nice information. And what you did with diagrams, and you can also do it mathematically, like you said, is to really figure out where is low Earth orbit, medium Earth orbit, and high Earth orbit, geosynchronous. LEO, MEO, GEO. Low Earth orbit is LEO. When you draw an accurate diagram cross-section of the Earth, we all draw a diagram where the atmosphere is a great big thick layer of stuff around the circle that represents the Earth. And it's, in reality, quite inaccurate. When you've got that globe sitting on your desk, which in some cases I guess is 8-10 inches in diameter, believe it or not, the atmosphere is not much thicker than the paint that's on that globe if you were doing it to a scale. And you can think about that. The atmosphere, the majority of the atmosphere is 6 miles high. After 6 miles, there's not very much atmosphere left. And the Earth is 4,000 miles in diameter. So there's almost a 1,000-to-1 ratio between the radius of the Earth and the height of the atmosphere. Or if you look at it as the diameter of the Earth versus the height of the atmosphere, it's more than a 1,000-to-1 ratio. So a low Earth orbit satellite is not very much above that atmosphere. It really hugs the Earth and doesn't see very much of the Earth all at once. If you're an astronaut on a low Earth orbit, like in the International Space Station, without a doubt, you're seeing a really pretty picture of the Earth. But the percentage of the Earth you're seeing at one time, it's calculatable. It's a very small few percent. Let me drop. But when you get up to geosynchronous orbit, 22,300 miles, that is 6 Earth radii out. You're out away from the Earth. Take the radius of the Earth, multiply it by 6. That's how far away geosynchronous orbit is. And boy, do you see a lot of Earth. That's the good news. You look at a lot of hardware all at once, a lot of countries all at once, a lot of spacecraft all at once. Like one-third of the Earth's surface area is in your view all at once. However, that extra distance means you get a heck of a lot extra loss to the signal and time delay. There was a period of time in which lots of people thought that to set up a couple of synchronous satellites, and now you've got an international telephone system. Yes and no. Telstar satellite was nowhere near synchronous orbit, and that was the very first time that the signals were sent internationally by way of satellite. And when it's in just the right position over the Pacific, over the Atlantic Ocean, you can communicate between the eastern United States and western Europe. And you can send telephone conversations through Telstar, and they would sound pretty good. You send the telephone conversation to all the way up to synchronous orbit, 22,000 miles. By the time the signal goes up and back, and you're having a conversation with somebody, you'll realize that the time delay is very annoying. You end up very frequently both talking and then both listening, end up talking on top of each other because of the time delay. And so telephone conversations by way of geosynchronous satellites became very unpopular, very fast, and thank goodness we weren't restricted just to undersea cables, the old-fashioned cable, where to get enough telephone conversations through there was difficult. Now that you get fiber optics under the sea, sending enough telephone conversations through a fiber optics cable, very easy. And very little loss, lots of bandwidth, all kinds of good things happen. Okay. Stand by while I flip over to the other input. I think I can do that now. We'll soon find out. If not, I'll come back. I'll be away for 30 seconds while I'm moving my antenna. I get a little better audio response out of the other input. Yeah, this is going to work a little bit better. And if I get grief on this one, then I'll go back again to the one I was at. The other thing you were talking about is the history. Yeah, NASA has had some terrible things happening at the end of January, beginning of February. And I can see why you could almost become superstitious. By the same token, of the Apollo missions, the only one that gave them a whole lot of grief was Apollo 13. So if you've got tristodectophobia, fear of the number 13, then Apollo 13 was the one that you don't want to be on that particular flight. And that was the one where an explosion of the command service module of an oxygen tank took place because of a heater that got jammed on because of the history of that particular repeater, that particular heater. So now, when it comes to, CubeSat, boy, Lithiana Sat 1, 10 by 10 centimeters. And I wonder what is the cost. Or is that service offered free of charge, I think, to somebody who can produce the right... give me a quick break on that one, John, Gretchen, Paul. Who pays for the launch and deploy of a CubeSat? WS2N, KQLAW, go ahead, Paul.
Working with the Bridgeport, and we're going to put up a CubeSat in 2015. right, back up, did three rights to X number of seconds here. Does that help us? That's 21FJM.
Okay, Mike, your signal is about 80% noise, 20% audio. I wonder if you're running full power, if your antenna is aimed at our eastern input, and if you can correct either one of those, I'd like you to repeat what you just said, because it sounded like awful good information. K1MJM, you've got it, Mike. K2RIW in the tech net.
We're going to put up a CubeSat in 2015, and there NASA is giving us and other organizations free ride.
Okay, Mike, at the beginning, you at the end. The last 10 seconds, you came through beautifully. So please repeat the beginning again. Here we go. K1MJM, K2RIW. Go ahead, Mike.
Yes, the Discovery Museum in Bridgeport is putting up a CubeSat. They're free rides into space.
So if I understand you correctly, University of Bridgeport is getting a free ride as a CubeSat. And they produce a piece of hardware that has gone through all the space qualification. Now, you and I may call it a free ride, and that means the launch, which normally is X number of $X million a pound, you don't have to pay for that. However, the process of developing the CubeSat and going through all the space qualification testing is still not going to be cheap. NASA doesn't want you putting up a piece of junk that's going to create a grief for other things that are in space or other things that are on board. So there's still a fairly stiff price for doing all the space qualification testing. I wonder if, have I got that correct, Mike? K1MJM, K2RIW in the tech net.
So that's a Discovery.
Yeah, sorry to say that didn't come through, Mike. Make one more attempt. Repeat that whole last transmission. I heard a couple of words. K1MJM, K2RIW.
Roger, that's... Only three.
You want me to repeat that thing, I heard?
Yeah, please repeat it all. Will you hear him on the input, Mike? Here we go. Boy, I'm terrible at names tonight. Paul, will you hear him on the input? Go right ahead, Paul.
QSL, no problem. Network Connecticut all the time, every Thursday. I know how to do it. $300,000 cost for them.
Okay. For a well-equipped University of Bridgeport, $300,000, that's just the outside dead foliage on their roll of money. I'm having some fun here. So that was the price of development, even though they got a free ride. Is that what Mike was telling us, Paul? Go ahead, Paul.
Discovery Museum.
Okay, I heard the price. If you wanted to tell me anything else, I could listen to on the input.
Say anything you want to, Mike, now that we've got a way of hearing you and being relayed, we'll hear whatever you say. K1MJM, K2RIW in the tech net.
Yes, thank you. That's...
Yeah, that's the Discovery Museum at Bridgeport. Discovery Museum at Bridgeport is what he's saying there.
So if I understand correctly, Discovery Museum of Bridgeport, are you saying they did the financing and it wasn't necessarily the University of Bridgeport, or Discovery Museum is where we can actually see a display of how the development took place? Give me a little clarification on that one, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Not too clear on that. It takes me a minute to switch off. Yeah, not a minute. It takes me about 10 seconds to switch frequencies when I'm doing it. So, I mean, if he transmitted on 147.975, I mean, this would be a lot easier. I don't know if he can do that.
Yeah, I thought he was transmitting on 147.975. Mike, you do or don't have the ability to transmit on our eastern input, K1MJM, K2RIW in the tech man.
147.975 is a little bit farther for me. It's quite a bit farther. I don't know if I'm coming through as well.
You're coming through very well right now. So a little bit noisy, but if you're running full power and you aimed at that particular repeater, go right ahead. Here we go. Go right ahead. Tell us whatever you want to, Mike. K1MJM, K2RIW in the tech man.
Project. There are University of Bridgeport students helping, but it's all based on the Discovery Museum proposal for, you know, the grant went to Discovery Museum of Bridgeport for the flight, their financing, everything.
Very fine, Mike. All of that came through. Okay, so the proposal was the Discovery Museum, and I think it was carried out by University of Bridgeport. When it comes to high technology schools, I haven't heard the name University of Bridgeport very often, but I'm down here on Long Island and part of New York State. I guess if I was living in southwestern Connecticut, I would know more about these things. Is that true, Mike? K1MJM, K2RIW?
K1MJM? They're not that well-known for their science program. They do have some new engineers, retired engineers as instructors that are getting a little more involved in these projects.
Very good. So, retired engineers, I think you're saying, are being involved. And as time goes on, people have more and more years of retirement. In theory, I retired at the very beginning of the year 2000, what was 14? 14 years ago, at the end of this month, actually the end of January, January 31 of 2000 is when I officially retired from Airborne Instruments Laboratory after working for them right out of school for 35 straight years. But then I opened a consulting business. So the word retirement is kind of relative. I call myself semi-retired. But the bottom line is people are living longer, health is getting better, therefore we've got more free time in our senior years when the children are graduated from college. You got a little bit of extra money left over. You got a whole lot of extra time, and pretty soon you get tired of golf and fishing and traveling, and you want to do something else. So developing a satellite, it's got to be a fun project. I've got a project that I think I'm going to get involved in, a blue sky project of a rock crusher antenna, which I'd like to develop in the next year. I've been talking about it for a long time. 10 gig antenna with a zillion dB of gain, a so-called periscope antenna system, something I've only done a little bit of experimenting with, and on paper it looks like it can be a real rock crusher. I've got 10 states on the 10 gig band. 10,368 megacycles is the calling frequency. Let me drop. Can you imagine a person who says, hello CQ, 10,000 megacycles, this is K2RIW, listening, carefully tuning the band. You say those words, and you're an absolute liar. The band is 500 megahertz wide. If you were carefully tuning the band, it would take you a year to go across the band by once. I'm exaggerating only a little bit. By gentleman's agreement, we all go on 10,368, which happens to be the 72 harmonic of 144. The guy's on 10 gigs. They start off with a 144 meg transmitter. Make it transmit, even though you think there's a filter in there, and you think that nothing but 144 is coming out. All kinds of harmonics is coming out of that transmitter when it's in the same shack with you. And listening to the 72nd harmonic on a sensitive 10 gig receiver is easy as all hell. And that becomes your calibration frequency. Then you know where you are, if you know what I mean. So, by gentleman's agreement, we all, when you say tuning the band, it means you're going to tune plus or minus 50 kilohertz around 10,368 to see if anybody is calling you. A fun band. So here I am. I've never run more than 0.2 watt on 10 gigs on single sideband and Morse code, mostly single sideband. I've talked to people in 10 states. Best DX is 380 miles to Rodan, Cape Hatteras, North Carolina. Over water path. You get a band opening every day on 10 gigs. I've never run more than 0.2 watt yet. I have the capability of running hundreds of watts. I can increase my signal by 1,000 to 1 in power, and by antenna gain, I can increase my signal another 10 to 1 in transmitter gain. Can you imagine what I could do on that band? I can come up 10,000 to 1 in power output by using a good antenna and the transmitters that I already own. All I got to do is hook up a power supply to the darn thing. And so, can a guy talk to 10 gigs to Florida, 1,200 miles? I know the answer is yes. The only thing to find out is, will I be able to do it 10 minutes per year or 100 hours per year? I don't know. I guarantee the band is opening on 10 gigs to Florida. It's an oval water pad. And the magic about 10 gigs is that if you're within 200 miles, let me drop. If you're within 200 miles of a major body of water, then on 10 gigs, you get a band opening some portion of every single 24-hour day. Ain't that amazing? Each ham band has got its own crazy characteristics. And so if you're progressive thinking and you want to try it, you want to go to the higher frequencies, you talk to Tom, WA1MBA, Mr. UHF-SHF, up there in the Boston area. His philosophy is no frequency is high enough, or no frequency is too high. The frontier is always at higher frequencies for ham radio. It always has been that way. And so things are not changing. The really progressive, these guys are running up 78 gigahertz and 120 gigahertz, 243 gigahertz. And yes, there's a ham band there, every octave of the band, and all above 300. Everything above 300 gigs, you own it. Do whatever you want with it for the time being. Just like ham radio, I think at one time, we owned everything above 30 megahertz because nobody thought you could go there. And so, and then there was a time when everything above 3 gigahertz, or is everything above 30 gigahertz, was about 20 years ago. Everything above 30 gigahertz, you owned it. And no license, no special permission was required, so to speak. Anybody with any further questions or comments on all of the above, give me your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
AC2LA with questions.
Information.
I heard both Paul, WS2N, and KC2LA. I'll pick you guys up in that order. Paul first, WS2N, K2RIW.
I just want to mention the one spacecraft, the Dream Chase, that we've talked about that on this net. It looks like a small space shuttle being built by Sierra Nevada in California. And their spacecraft has actually got a date now with NASA. NASA gave them a flight date. He launched on top of the Atlas V. That's the same one, same rocket that put the Tejas up there last week. In November of 2016, so they're getting there little by little. That will be able to carry up to 7 passengers and also cargo and everything. And so that's being developed. It's going to go up. When it comes down, it's going to land like the space shuttle on a runway. Things are moving along. It'll take a while. The first unmanned flight, 2016 November, and then followed soon after that by manned flight back to
the one that I'm really looking for, though, I think is going to be the mind blower, is James Webb. Tell me your best guess right now. How well is the project on James Webb going, and when will it be launched? And then I'll go over to LA right after that. Go ahead, Paul.
They're on schedule for a 2018 launch, and that's to be launched from French Guiana by an Ariane 5 rocket. That's their big launch vehicle. The European Space Agency is involved with us on this one. They're gonna be the launch vehicle. So 2018 looks good to be put out in L2, Lagrange Point 2.
Very fine. And now I thought it was KC2LA. I bet you it's AC2LA. Let's see. Daniel, if I... Yeah, Daniel. AC2LA. Go right ahead, Daniel. K2RIW on the TechNet.
Thank you very much. Yep, it's AC2LA, just like Atlantic City to Los Angeles.
name, Dan. And just had a question about the 10 gigahertz that you were talking about. You said that you might be able, or you know you would be able to make it down to Florida on 10 gigahertz, but you're not sure how often. So my question is, what are the mechanics of the propagation to make your radio wave go that far on 10 gigahertz? Is it like Troppo? Is it Meteor? And I'm pretty sure it's not F2 or maybe E-skip. So I'm just wondering what drives propagation at 10 gigahertz.
Don, good question, Daniel, or Dan. If you look at the records of where, you think, now what organization did this testing? Was it the FCC, MIT, among other people? There was a series of articles about tropospheric, forward-propagated tropospheric propagation. Forward-propagated tropospheric propagation. Atmospheric and homogeneities. MIT, among other organizations, had a number of articles in the IEEE proceedings, 20 years ago on this one. When you're getting above, let me pick a number, 1,000 megahertz, for all practical purposes, there is no ionosphere. There is no sporadic E. When you study the way the ionosphere and the E cloud does reflecting, the amount of reflection you get, you call it reflection, it's actually a little more complicated than that, but the reflection you get goes down as either frequency squared or frequency cubed, so it decreases real fast. So by the time you get to 1,000 megs above, there is no ionosphere. It's only the atmosphere. But the atmosphere is a beautiful propagator, even though you don't think so. And there's two separate modes, atmospheric and homogeneity. In other words, you get a cloud here and a puff of red, hot air there and so on, where the signal coming along sees a slightly different dielectric constant. And when it hits this blob of atmosphere that's a slightly different dielectric constant, signal scattering takes place. It's a little bit like having clear water and you put the white flakes of something in the water. You're going to get reflections off those flakes, if you know what I mean, if you send signals into them. They're going to be, they're going to absorb some signal and re-radiate. Anything that can absorb a radio signal will re-radiate it. A dipole antenna, by the way, the so-called Project Westford, which was an experiment where they took a whole lot of little bitty microwave pieces of 30-gauge or 40-gauge wire, all cut to be a half wavelength long at some microwave frequencies. A satellite distributed these things into an orbit around the Earth. And now you send a signal up to these little bitty dipoles, and those dipoles would absorb and re-radiate, and they were a beautiful reflecting medium. And the good news is they did a great job. Let me drop. The good news is they did a good job of reflecting. The bad news is because they're so low in mass, their mass-to-area ratio is such that even though they were high enough up where the atmosphere is supposed to be very thin, they experienced atmospheric drag, re-entered the atmosphere within a year. So Project Westford worked, but only very briefly, okay? But the atmosphere has a little bit of inhomogeneities. But the much bigger thing is called super refraction phenomenon. Quite a few times during the year, you'll get a weather condition where you've got high humidity air low down close to the Earth and lower humidity air up high. The high humidity air, because water has a dielectric constant of 81, air got a dielectric constant of 1. So the high humidity air, the radio signal propagates more slowly through it compared to the dry air. Therefore, when you send out a signal toward the horizon and it sees this slower propagating, lower velocity of propagation, what's the word, velocity factor air, it becomes bent downward. So when you get the right atmospheric condition, that signal will go 10 times and maybe even 100 times beyond your radio horizon. The signal will be bent down, and the so-called super refraction phenomena is when the rate at which the signal is bent downward follows Earth's curvature. That guy I talked to with his 3-foot dish on a tripod radiating 1 watt of power sitting on Cape Hatteras at a beach in Rodin, he went to a research